As a parish minister serving a small congregation in Massachusetts, but then she became senior minister of the Church of the Larger Fellowship until she retired a few years back. I've always appreciated this note of hers for Mother's Day, which I have edited. Mother's Day, now that's a tricky one, at least for a minister, or at least for this minister. I don't want to exclude those of you who aren't mothers. I don't want to open wounds for you who are mourning for your mothers or your children, or for whom the relationship with your mother or your children is painful. And so many people are adopted, or have placed babies for adoption, adding layers of complexity. We are single parents, we are gay, we are incarcerated, we are step-parents, non-custodial parents, women hoping to get pregnant, potential parents hoping for children. We live in a society that moved beyond the ordinary Mother's Day platitudes long ago. Yet during the course of my ministry, parishioners have offered me a steady stream of articles, books, and websites about, well, mothering. I think I finally heard the message that a lot of people would like to hear a little something about mothers on Mother's Day. The kind of thing where, if you have a mother around, you could share it with her. Something on the sentimental side. So what if she's a corporate executive, NASCAR driver, union boss, or crossing guard? So what if the short-term memory loss is getting the best of her, or motherhood wasn't really her strong suit, or she claims not to want the attention? So what if you're busy and broke and she's as annoying as ever? So what? That's what you seem to be telling me. What does your mother want to hear? She was born into a particular time and circumstance. She made some choices among a few or a great many. At some point, you showed up, and she loved you the best way she could. She put it all together into a life. As cultural anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson put it, she composed her life. Not only did your mother compose a life, chances are good that she composed a life that included you. She didn't always call the shots perfectly, but statistics tell us she was probably a pretty good mom. Now that you look back, she was the best mom when it came to something. I think she'd like to hear it. And of course, there's the love, a force of nature, yet an intricate composition. I know moms can't always do this right. Sometimes we just don't have it in us, or it manifests in quirky or destructive ways. But most moms, it seems to me, love their kids. And in fact, most kids love their moms. So often, it works out great. What does your mother most want to hear? That you love her. Well, even at the time, we knew she was not real at all, always in dresses and pearls. But she was white, as all mothers were. She was a stay-at-home mom, as all moms were. She was married with children, two boys in this case. For me and millions like me growing up in the 1950s, June Cleaver was representative of the vast array of motherhood as we knew it. June would never cuss, shout, or get depressed. Ward would never beat her up. The Cleaver family lived in a large two-story house in a suburban neighborhood, and Ward went to some kind of office every day. Leave It to Beaver was one TV show my parents and I would routinely watch together, running for 6 years from October 4, 1957 until June 20, 1963, 234 episodes in all. The series could have gone on, except the child stars were growing up, and so the series would not have been able to retain its charm. It detailed the adventures of parents Ward and June Cleaver and their boys, Theodore Beaver Cleaver and his older brother, Wally. They made a nice family, no one of them perfect, but mild and amusing in their imperfections and insights. With stories told from the point of view of Wally and the Beaver, the sitcom was popular. I still like it when I can see a random episode today. What we saw on our black and white TV screens, three channels to choose among, reflected what many of us saw in our homes and families. Like many cities in 1950s America, Kansas City, Missouri had an invisible but largely impenetrable wall running from north to south through the city. East of the wall lived non-white people. West of the wall, called Paseo Avenue, lived the majority. The wall divided not merely neighborhoods, but two coexistent cities, only one of which we knew. On one side lived Ward, June, Wally Beaver, and Donna Reed, Lucille Ball, and the Father Knows Best family, and our families too. And on the other side, in the other city, who knew? Even going to the University of Missouri at Kansas City and earning a degree in sociology left me still on the right side of the wall, the safe one. Then in the summer before going to seminary in Chicago, I got a job doing mental health research. It was a massive mental health survey of the entire city, and our job was to go to addresses randomly chosen to administer about a 30-minute verbal questionnaire. Depending on the answers, the survey would detect differences in self-esteem and incidences of depression among the various socioeconomic groups in the city. By the time I joined the project in the summer of 1969, by the time I joined, all the good addresses had been taken. The addresses left to survey were all on the other side of the wall in that other city. And so, because I needed the money and because I am, according to those who know me best, incredibly stubborn, I crossed the wall. You know what I saw, no real surprise, and no June Cleavers. I saw poverty, African-American mothers, yes, hundreds. Usually I was the only white person in the neighborhoods I visited with my briefcase, glasses, and sincerity. And they took me in. For 3 months, I went to the homes of this parallel universe. And I was afraid, yes, some of the time, but how good and important it was for me to go into homes stifling with the heat and humidity of a Midwestern summer. No air conditioning in sight. Homes untouched by the war on poverty, but ravaged by other kinds of wars. Guns and gangs were not, in 1969, what they are in America today, and drug usage and sales were different too. But the mothers I met cared for their kids, yes, lived in pain and poverty and untreated diseases and a failed educational system for their kids, that too. And because it was summertime, I saw their kids, and I saw love, abundant love and caring. Some walls have come down in America, we say, but plenty remain. And many of us still think of moms as white and middle class. But 50.4% of Americans under the age of one in 2013 are minority children, and that percentage is only increasing. But I know something else as well. I spent important years with Ward and June and Wally and the Beaver. 6 years, actually. A lot of growing up years. And this is what I know to be true of that family. They would want those walls to come down. They were believers in fairness. They believed, I know, that we are one family, one humanity. Whatever we believe, however we are divided by differences in pigmentation, they knew that we are one family, that mothers try to love their children whatever obstacles they face, and that every family, however it's constituted, strives to be loving. I know the Cleaver family well, and I know that on Mother's Day 2013, in America, were they still here to say it, they would say the walls still have to come down. And in their absence, we must say it for them, that in the fullness of time, love wins.
You probably saw the photos of me officiating for one of Colorado's first civil unions about 11 days ago. Okay. We did send them out in the extra and posted a few on the Facebook page, so if you haven't seen them, you can check them out. It was a really wonderful night and a long time coming for this one-time hate state. Crossing the street to the building that houses the clerk's office at about 11:30 p.m., the line stretched out into the street and around the corner. Hundreds of same-sex couples were there to finally claim the rights that had been so long denied them. And as a part of a group of clergy and judges, I was there to officiate and make official their legal recognition. It was an especially meaningful night for me as I was asked for my friend of 20 years to officiate for him and his longtime partner. Jeffrey and I sat together in my very first college class, and I am his eldest son's godmother. Actually, I was present at both his sons' birth, and I believe I sat out on the front porch of his house with him the night after he and Mark went on their first date for a little debrief. We were neighbors back then. These many years later, it was my great joy to be able to pronounce Jeffrey and Mark's relationship legally recognized by the state of Colorado. And yet, and without taking away any of the joy we all felt that night, I will say that in the days after the event, especially on the day that Jeffrey and Mark and their sons were featured on Time Magazine's website, very surreal, I kept hearing in my mind the title of an article, or perhaps a sermon, that I would want to write. And it went like this: Civil Unions in the Age of It's Complicated. Now, for those of you not on Facebook or up on your recent Meryl Streep movies, It's Complicated is one of the choices that Facebook gives you for how to designate your relationship status: single, in a relationship, married, or it's complicated. And as Mark was describing, we do indeed live in a time where more and more relationships, more and more family systems would best be characterized by that last category: it's complicated. And on that night, as we celebrated Colorado's first civil unions, however, what we lifted up was not really the complicated story, it was the familiar and even traditional story of two people, two parents who live and love and parent and partner together. And we should give that recognition, that affirmation. We should celebrate and give thanks that our society finally recognizes this loving relationship in the same ways that it recognizes heterosexual couples. And yet, even as we lifted up these couples, I started to see this possible unintended consequence. That is, by making certain relationships more recognizable and more legitimate, it had the increasing potential to make these other more complicated elements of our society's family systems less recognizable and less legitimate. To get specific, Jeffrey and Mark, whose union I solemnized that night, they're co-parents with two women, Indra and Allison. Indra gave birth to one of their sons, and Allison to another. Before Jeffrey met Mark, Allison, Indra, and Jeffrey were already a family unit. Having met in college, they hatched a dream of co-parenting together, a dream that actually came true with the birth of their son, Zian. Now, although technically at the time, Indra and Allison were primary partners and Jeff was single, we used to joke that if there was any domestic partnership most solidly at the center of their family system, it was actually Jeffrey and Allison who were and are really good at navigating and directing the domestic components of family life. Since Zian's birth 12 years ago, there have been many changes, beginning with Jeffrey meeting Mark, but then shortly thereafter, the birth of their second son, Elliot. Much more recently, Indra and Allison have ended their primary partnership and have since found new partners, Edith and Alex. And so those children, so singularly featured as having their two fathers in that picture in Time magazine, they actually have somewhere in the range of six parents. And in terms of a nuclear family, there are way more than that, and I would count myself among them. My friends might be the paradigmatic example of today's "it's complicated" family system, but certainly they are far from alone. Mark and I came up with the title of my message today after he was telling me his hopes to explore the changing face of motherhood, and I started listing the different forms of motherhood and family just in my own neighborhood. Our most immediate neighbor is a white family with a mom and a dad and a 5-year-old son. The parents are older and working class. Often people will ask them if they're the grandparents. The mom works long, hard hours, and mostly the little boy is raised in a daycare or in a neighbor's home, including ours. Across the street, there's two teenagers, a boy and a girl, both white with a single mom. They get picked up every morning by a friend on a bike, and they all go off to school together. I don't ever see the kids come home. I only see the mom return, usually working hard in the garden and mowing the lawn. Next to them, there's an African-American elderly man and his wife. Every weekend and often after school, their grandsons arrive, three of them, ranging in age from 2 to 9. My kids barely notice that those grandsons don't actually live there. That's how often they're around. One door up from them, another African-American family, this one with a brother and a sister, adults, each with their own kids that they're raising together. Often there are other adults in and out of the house. One man in particular who I'm pretty sure does most of the looking out for those kids. Another door down, a new family, white, just moved in from Portland, mom and dad with two boys, very young. The parents work a split shift, so one of them is always home with the boys. And I often wonder if those parents ever see each other. And then, of course, there's us, two white women raising our two children, both adopted. So often my kids will tell you they have three moms, including their birth mom, though neither has seen their birth mom since they were infants. And truly, there are way more adults than this who help with our mothering. Our daughter is Hispanic, my son, we say, race unknown, and both, we are all quickly realizing, are PKs. Do you know the term? Pastor's kids. When we speak about motherhood today, and when we speak about family life today, it is indeed complicated. Who are the mothers in these stories that I've shared? In the story of my friends, or in these little stories from my neighborhood, who are the mothers? And who does the mothering? Increasingly, it's complicated. Being a mom or mothering seems to have less to do with your sex or your biological connection, with your physical resemblance, or even with your proximity, and much more to do with the roles you willingly, lovingly, and faithfully fulfill. And personally, I think this is a good thing. So even as we are lifting up the traditional vision of a couple as the center of domestic life, expanding it as we are now to include same-sex couples, we must also keep finding ways to affirm all the many ways that families take shape and recognize all the many forms of motherhood alive today and seek ever greater ways of honoring the creative forms families find to care for each other, to make and fulfill promises to one another, and to live out the hope and the heartbreak of this difficult and beautiful life. On this Mother's Day, let us give thanks for mothers past, present, and future, in all their many forms and all their varied ways. We are grateful.